We've kind of been going through this series on the lectionary. And, you know, the lectionary calendar is something that we follow every now and then. And it's just basically something that where the text, the scriptures, have been pre-selected each week. And so all the different churches that go through the lectionary, they kind of talk through the exact same passages each Sunday. So what we're doing this morning, we're going through the same passages as many churches around the world are going through right now. So that's pretty neat. And so, you know, we usually do this during the season of Advent, which is, you know, during Christmas. And then we also do this during the season of Lent, which is when Easter is. And so those are what's known as the sacred time during the year. And then during the summer and for the rest of the year, it's what's known as ordinary time. And it's just a way of, during this ordinary time for us to figure out, you know, what does it mean for us, you know, to live the life, death, and resurrection of Christ just, you know, in our regular, ordinary, everyday lives. And so this morning, I want to take a look at this idea of anticipation. Because there are things, you know, in our lives that we all look forward to, or maybe we're waiting for, or maybe we're preparing for. As most of you know, Rachel and I are expecting number 3 in December. And, you know, a couple weeks ago, we actually found out that we're having another girl. You know, Zachary and I are going to be outnumbered. And it's funny because Zachary and I were talking a couple nights ago, and he was, you know, talking to me about, you know, what his life is like with Gabby. And, you know, he was telling me, he's like, "Dad, having a little sister is really tough, huh? Like, it's really hard work, right?" And I'm thinking, you know, you're right, buddy, it is. And, you know, you've been doing a great job. You've been a great brother, you know, great big brother, just, you know, handling everything she throws your way. Like, literally, I mean, she throws stuff at him. And so, you know, for him, when we told him that we were having another girl, you know, he was trying to be excited and happy. You know, he was like, "Oh, yay, I'm having another sister. Yay." And, you know, I feel for him. But, you know, for Rachel and I, we're excited to kind of plan for another baby. Now we know that's a girl, you know, thinking of names. You know, we're trying to predict what her, you know, personality is going to be like. You know, is she going to be all sweet or all sass, right? And so we're trying to, you know, it's exciting just to figure out what it's going to be like. And we all have things that we look forward to or excited about. And so maybe just real quick with the person next to you, you know, share about something recently maybe that you were looking forward to or that you were excited about. Maybe it was an event or maybe somewhere that you were going, maybe something you were getting. But real quick, just with the person next to you, share, you know, something that you were recently anticipating. All right, so throw out some of these things. I want to hear some of these things. Throw out something. What were some of you guys anticipating? What were you guys looking forward to? A hot date. Leslie, hot date? No? Oh, Marsha, hot date. Nice. Has it happened yet? Has it happened already? No. Thursday. All right, we'll keep on the lookout for your update Thursday. Check out Marsha's tweets. Anything else? Anything else you guys were looking forward to? Dolores. Going to Washington. Washington State or D.C.? D.C. All right, nice. Yeah, it should be nice weather there, too. Anyone else? Something you're looking forward to? Football season, very soon. Fantasy football, right? Fantasy, yeah, there you go. But, you know, when it comes to creating anticipation, you know, for their products, no one does it better than Apple, right? I mean, people are constantly, you know, looking for rumors and just leaks of what's coming up. They're always waiting for that next big thing. Recently, I came across this really exciting video, so check it out.
Is buzzing over Apple's latest must-have gadget, the MacBook Wheel, a revolutionary new laptop that does away with the keyboard. TechTrends reporter Jeff Tate has more.
Thanks, Andrea. Say goodbye to the keyboard and hello to the future of laptop computers. With the MacBook Wheel, Apple has replaced the traditional keyboard with a sleek, touch-sensitive click wheel. Apple CEO Steve Jobs introduced the product yesterday at the annual Mac Expo. Senior product innovator Brian Gilman says the MacBook Wheel will make typing a thing of the past.
At Apple, our philosophy is create products that are simple to use, and nothing's more simple than a single giant button.
Gilman showed me how the revolutionary new computer works.
Just open the Intuitype alphabet menu here, scroll to the letter you need, see, and center click to select it. Then click again to capitalize, and repeat this process for each new letter. It couldn't be simpler.
Huh.
You can also let the predictive sentence technology complete the sentence for you.
Gilman says the MacBook wheel has also simplified the organization of files, so searching your hard drive will be a snap.
Just press both sides of the wheel concurrently and center click in there. You have an alphabetical listing of every file on your hard drive. Everything is just a few hundred clicks away.
Apple is calling the MacBook wheel the most intuitive product ever designed.
Here at Apple, we like to think that we're giving customers features they don't even realize they want yet.
While the MacBook wheel won't hit the shelves for another 3 to 15 months, many Apple users already have it on their wish list.
I'll buy almost anything if it's shiny and made by Apple.
Alex Zalbin was one of the lucky few to get to try out a Mac wheel and spent 45 minutes typing an email to his friend.
I never really realized how much I hated keyboards until I saw this thing. I like how the email automatically says sent from a MacBook wheel. That way people know you have one.
With a price tag of just under $2,600 for the lowest-end MacBook wheel, it is an investment. But the super-thin laptop features numerous innovations like the new ultra-thin Hummingbird battery, which can power the MacBook wheel for a full 19 minutes before needing to be recharged. And the computer is virtually unbreakable unless dropped or hit.
So just to clarify, right, that's not real. All right, some of you guys were like, I need to go to the Apple Store right now. 45 minutes to write an email. But we've seen people all, line up hours, days, sometimes they'll camp out weeks just to get their hands on some of these products, right? And for them, they feel like it's worth, the relatively short wait to actually get in their hands something that they've been waiting for. But what about some of those more long-term things? Things that, might be months, years, sometimes even lifetime away. Whether it's, finding a spouse, right, and finding out who that is going to be and going through that whole process. Or maybe it's parents, finding out what your kid's going to grow up to be like and just, what you've trained and how you, what you've taught your kid. Or maybe even just retirement, what's life going to be like after work? And for some of these things, there's a long-term investment that sometimes we don't necessarily get to know or even see the results immediately. And if you look in Scripture and just what Jesus talks about, we see, we read a lot about how, he's going to come back one day, right? And that somehow we need to be ready, we need to be waiting for that moment. And it's been a couple thousand years already. And for us, sometimes it's difficult, even for me to really connect to that idea of anticipating Christ's return. We find it a bit hard to think about. It's not really at the forefront of our mind. And so this morning, the question I want to look at is, what are some of those barriers, that keep us from living and anticipating Christ's return? Why is it so hard for us to connect with that? And then maybe what are some of the things, the rhythms that we can develop that can help us to live in anticipation of Christ's return? And so this morning, we're going to look at what Jesus taught his disciples, take a look at how he describes this life that, of anticipation and what it looks like. So before we jump in, why don't you grab your Bibles, grab a couple people around you, and go ahead and read Luke chapter 12, verse 32 to 40, just to give you some context about what we'll be talking about this morning. So Luke 12, verse 32 to 40, I'll give you a couple minutes to read that to each other. All right, so let's start at the beginning. Jesus starts out in verse 32. He says, "Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom." And so Jesus starts out here, telling his disciples not to be afraid. And this is a common theme that we see throughout this chapter. At the beginning of the chapter, he tells them not to be afraid of dying, right? Because life after death is what's more important. And then later on in the chapter, he talks about, tells them not to worry, right? Don't worry about what you're going to eat, what you're going to wear. God takes care of the birds, the flowers. You're much more important than those things. And I think the point that he's trying to get at is that the things you worry about, the things that we're fearful of, right, they're just tied to this temporary world. And so while, we're busy being bogged down by these temporary troubles, God's over here, trying to offer us his kingdom, right? Everything that's part of it, everything he has to offer, including heaven, including what he's doing here on earth, including the spiritual gifts that he has, his love, his peace, his hope, his joy. And for us, it's not an easy thing for us to really embrace that, right? It sounds great in theory, but in practice, there are a lot of things that hold us back from wanting to pursue his kingdom. And so he continues in verse 33. He says, "Sell your possessions and give to the poor. provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will not be exhausted, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. You know, and so he knows that there are things that hold us back. And so when he tells us, you know, to sell our stuff and give it away, it's more than just about helping the needy, right? I don't think that's really his main emphasis here. But Jesus understands that our money, the stuff that we have, those are the things that we hold on to the most, right? Those are the things that we have difficulty letting go, because we just have this desire to pursue wealth, you know, to collect as much as we can for ourselves. Earlier in the chapter, Jesus tells a story about this rich man who had, you know, a huge harvest. He just had a huge return on his crops. And so, you know, he had so much that he ran out of room, ran out of places to store this surplus. And so instead of, you know, giving away the extra stuff to people that, you know, might need it, he comes up with the plan to basically knock down his, you know, all his existing barns and then just build some new, bigger ones so that he could hold it all. And so in his mind, he feels like he's set for life, right? For him, he's going to sit back and enjoy all of this for himself. And in the story, right, God tells him that he's a fool for hoarding all this stuff for himself because he doesn't know that literally that night he's going to die. And what Jesus is trying to do is, you know, he's trying to shake up people's value system. That, you know, the value we place on things are sometimes backwards. And it actually makes it easier for us to let go of things when we reset that value system. Maybe it's like this. So I think it was last year, there was a baseball game, and we see this little girl and the value that she places on a baseball. Right, check out this highlight.
He does go after him there, and delivers a fastball, a shot to the upper deck, caught by that fan right there. Nice grab.
Oh, wow.
Whoa, there it goes.
Well, she's only doing what she sees them do all the time, and that is to throw the ball back on the field. But you know, when that happens, the parent is never able to catch them before they end up doing it.
And there's a whole host of fans underneath that gentleman right there who are looking for another souvenir.
Well, he just missed that ball as he fouls that ball. Oh, nice grab.
That's a really good grab.
She says, well, let me have it. Let me have it, Dad. Thanks. Well, here it goes.
That little girl is going to be looking for a baseball for the rest of the game.
Right, and for this little girl, you know, she doesn't have necessarily the same value placed on this ball as maybe other people would, right? Because it is rare to catch a foul ball in a baseball game. But her intent was never to hold on to it and, you know, be overprotective about it. You know, and I think for me, my tendency is to want to collect things, want to keep things for myself, want to, you know, just hold on to things. And so seeing this was actually really refreshing, right? That to see her just, you know, let loose and let go and throw the ball away. And I think it's difficult. The reason it's difficult for us to let go of things is because of the value that we place on them. And Jesus is saying, you know, that we've placed the wrong value on money and on possessions. And somehow we need to let go of those things. And so he gets to the source of it all in verse 34. He says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Right? Whatever your prized possessions are, whatever you feel like has the most value in your life, right? That's where you're most invested. You know, your emotions, your time, your energy, your thoughts, your focus. Your heart follows whatever you value most. And it's an easy test for us, right? If you think about, you know, what is it that causes us the most worry? Or what is it that we fear most losing? Right? And that's probably what we treasure the most. And a lot of times, those are the things that become a barrier, right? That keep us from living a life of anticipation and really pursuing his kingdom. And so that's why Jesus is so determined, you know, to get us to give up the material wealth that we have. And so what does that mean for us? You know, maybe we need to reevaluate the values we've placed on the things in our lives, right? The possessions that we own, the money that we make, you know, the stuff and the lifestyle that we pursue. And in order to counteract the pull that those things have on us, you know, maybe we need to practice generosity, like Jesus suggested, that we develop this rhythm, you know, where we, you know, give on a regular basis, give our stuff away. We let go of the things in our lives. And for us, you know, being generous is more than just about preventing greed, but maybe somehow I think it actually frees us up so that our heart can actually care about God's kingdom. And then he continues in verse 35. He says, "Be dressed, ready for service, and keep your lamps burning, like men waiting for their master to return from a wedding banquet. So when he comes and knocks, they can immediately open the door for him. It will be good for those servants whose master finds them watching when he comes." And so Jesus, you know, starts telling another story about some servants that, you know, are waiting for their master to come back from some wedding celebration, you know, possibly his own. And traditionally, you know, these banquets and these feasts would last, you know, up to 7 days. And these dinners would go, you know, late into the night. And so it could be up to a week before he comes back. And even on the night that he gets back, you know, we see in the next couple of verses, it could be anywhere, you know, from 9 p.m. to 3 in the morning. But regardless of when he comes back, right, he wants to find his servants on task. That maybe, right, it's a matter of whether or not they're ready and prepared the moment he arrives. You know, when we first had Zachary, when he was first born, Rachel and I were not very prepared for it. You know, we were living up in Dallas at the time, and, you know, his due date was late May. And so in February, we took one of the birthing preparation classes at the hospital. You know, so they're teaching stuff like breathing techniques, you know, what to pack and bring to the hospital, you know, just overview of what to prepare for this birth. And so early April, one morning, Rachel wakes up. And she's like, "My water broke." And for me, right, this is like my first pregnancy or experience with pregnancy, or not really my pregnancy, but, you know, this was our first experience. I really didn't understand everything that was involved. So when she was like, "My water broke," I didn't know what that meant, you know? And I'm like, "Can we fix it?" Right? Like, how did this water break? You know, because I'm the problem solver in the relationship. And she's like, no, we need to go to the hospital now, right? Where's the bag that we need? I'm like, "What bag?" And she's like, "You know, the bag that we need, you know, for the hospital." I'm like, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, they said we don't need that bag until, you know, you're in labor." And she grabs me, looks at me like, "I am in labor," right? So I'm like, "Oh, I'm starting to figure this out now." So I'm running around the house trying to grab stuff. We rush over to the hospital, you know, and it turns out she needs an emergency C-section. And then before we know it, you know, the baby's out. And, you know, obviously we were very unprepared for this. You know, it was like we failed our first test as parents. Our instructor would have been so disappointed in us. But, you know, for us, we didn't think that he was going to come that early. And, you know, the things that we needed to take care of, we didn't do. And so if you look back at verse 35, you know, Jesus describes a couple of things that we should be doing that, you know, these servants did. One, they were dressed for work. Right, so literally it says they tied up their garments so that they would be more effective in doing their chores and their responsibilities. And then second, they kept their lamps burning. So it's, you know, it was this continual process of maintaining their lamps. You know, they had to make sure they were trimmed. They had to replace the oil when, you know, when it was out. And so this waiting, you know, even though it was waiting, there was an active sense to it. Right, it wasn't just, you know, mindless inactivity. There was an article in Time magazine this week, the cover story, you know, talking about the impact that summer vacation has on students and the school system. And I was talking about how, you know, for kids that come from lower income families, right, for them, summer becomes a season of boredom, of inactivity, of isolation, because all they do is just sit in front of a TV screen all day. Whereas people, you know, kids that have resources or have access, you know, they can go on family vacations, they can go on, you know, field trips, they can go on summer camps, you know, they visit museums and libraries, and so they're able to exercise their mind through the summer. And so there was a study that was done that, you know, regardless of economic status, you know, during the school year, all the kids progressed about the same level. But then by the end of the summer, a lot of these disadvantaged kids would fall back. And so the cumulative effect of, you know, summer after summer, year after year, the slide, the study found that by the end of middle school, a lot of these low-income kids were 3 years behind. And then by the end of ninth grade, they said that two-thirds of that, you know, learning gap could be blamed on the summers, right? Just the inactivity. You know, and that confirms what we know, that, you know, inactivity, for the most part, right, isn't a good thing, is not something that leads to positive things. And for us, right? If we take a snapshot of our lives and what we're doing right now, right, does it reflect an active role in the mission of Christ? You know, are we using the gifts we have to be the hands and feet of Christ to those around us? And, you know, if we take a look at our abilities, you know, our skills, our talents, you know, maybe we're actually using them, selfishly for our own agenda. Or maybe we're not even using them. That somehow what we're doing right now doesn't connect with who God's made us to be. And so maybe that's another barrier for us, you know, in trying to live in anticipation of his return. You know, it's like the story that Jesus told about, you know, this business owner, right, that left his employees with just boatloads of cash, told them to go invest it while he was away on a business trip. You know, and so, you know, two of these guys jump right on it. You know, they start putting this money to work. They invest it. They look for creative ways to turn profit. And so when the boss comes back, they've basically doubled it. But this third guy, right, he just hides the money. He digs a hole in the back of his house and just leaves it there, doesn't even touch it. For him, he didn't value what he was given or the responsibility that came with it. And so what does that mean for us? You know, at Vox, you know, we try to create these avenues and create opportunities for us to use, you know, the gifts that God's given us. You know, that's why we talk so much about, you know, living the church and not just attending it. That somehow, you know, we believe that each person, you know, has something, you know, they can contribute in our expression of church. And that's what liturgy is, this, you know, what we do each Sunday morning. It literally means work of the people. That somehow it becomes a reflection of who we are as a community, right? From the prayers to the readings to, you know, the benediction to snacks to greenhouse, everything we do, somehow, you know, we hope that you can be involved and use how God's gifted you. You know, or even things that you want to start. You know, last week we had this little survey we passed out, just looking for ways that you can plug in and use some of your abilities. And even for Space 12, right? I mean, Space 12, that's one of the reasons we took a step of faith and signed the lease on this place right after, you know, it shut down from being Chester's nightclub. And we renovated it into this community space to hopefully connect, you know, with the neighborhood, connect with the city. And so whatever it is, you know, whether it's art, music, you know, tutoring, computer skills, you know, even sewing, right? The idea is that we want you to use this space to somehow use your gifts and abilities so that, you know, you can connect with this city, connect with this neighborhood. And through that and in those relationships, hopefully connect people to Christ. And so the point is, you know, there needs to be a connection between who God's made you, you know, what opportunities he's brought you into, and then actively using those talents while we're waiting. And so be dressed for service and keep your lamps burning like men waiting for their master to return from a wedding banquet. And then Jesus finishes up in verse 39. It says, "But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have let his house be broken into. You also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him." And so here Jesus is saying, right, he is going to return, right? I mean, that's a certainty. But when that's happening, right, no one really knows. And he compares it to a thief breaking into a house. And it's interesting that the phrase broken into there, literally it actually means dug into. And so, you know, back in the day, you know, those houses were usually made out of dried mud. And so for someone to break in, basically they would dig through the wall to break into someone's house. And so obviously that takes a longer process. And so they're going to have to find a more opportune time, some time that's not expected, where they can actually dig through. And, you know, in general, right, a thief's going to find a moment where it's unexpected or a moment where you're not prepared, you know, usually when you're gone or usually when you're asleep. You know, there have been a few times when someone's broken into our car. In the back, we usually park in the back of our house, and it always happens at night, right? Because in the morning, when I leave the house, you know, I see the car door open, you know, everything has been rummaged through, things have been dumped out, and they're just really looking for money. So, you know, the little coin tray that I have there, it's always empty by the time they've gone through it, and so I've learned not to refill the coin tray, and they've stopped coming. You know, but even in, you know, for Space 12, there have been a couple attempts, you know, of break-ins. You know, someone tried taking a crowbar and prying the back door open. Someone's tried, you know, to break through the trailer door when we used to store it here in the parking lot. But those things always happened when no one was around or when it was really, really late at night. And for anyone, right, who's experienced, you know, a break-in, whether it's a house, apartment, you know, your car, it's one of those things where you feel helpless about, right? You feel violated, you feel angry, you feel maybe frustrated, because there really isn't anything you can do. You know, basically it happens and it catches you completely off guard. And Matthew, you know, kind of expands on this idea a bit in Matthew 24 when he says, you know, that not even the angels know when Jesus is coming back. And he kind of compares it to the flood in the days of Noah, where people were just, you know, living life, eating, drinking, you know, they were getting married, having kids, and then bam, right? The flood wipes them all out. Completely unexpected. And that's what he says Christ's return is going to be like. It's unpredictable, unexpected. You know, and I don't think we're very comfortable with that idea, because we like to, you know, have control over what happens in our lives, you know, when those things happen. And maybe that's why so many people, you know, come up with their theories and predictions, you know, of when, you know, Jesus, exactly when Jesus is coming back. So that, you know, if we can try to figure this out, then maybe somehow we still have control over the situation. And even though Jesus did give us, you know, some signs to look for before he comes back, right, ultimately there's no way we can know when. And that's the point, right? It's supposed to be unexpected. And for us, because, you know, I think our lives are centered around scheduling and planning, you know, efficiency, that somehow we've lost that mystery and that surprise of the unexpected. And sometimes, you know, our desire to control our lives, our desire to control when things happen, that ends up being a barrier that keeps us from living in anticipation. And so for us, you know, maybe we need to make interruptions, you know, make the unexpected a part of our daily rhythm. You know, because I can be very selfish with my time. You know, if I have a predetermined schedule, you know, and there's an unplanned interruption, you know, to me, I view it as an inconvenience. And maybe that's why we need to practice this idea of hospitality, when Paul talks about it in the book of Romans, right? And hospitality back in that day had a very different meaning, because it was a huge part of their way of life. You know, that was the only way they could travel long distances, was they had to rely on the hospitality of other people. So, you know, so people would just randomly show up at your front door looking for a meal, looking for a place to stay. And so maybe for us to practice hospitality isn't necessarily, you know, throwing a nice dinner party for our friends, but it's maybe more about embracing the interruptions of our life, you know, the people or the different opportunities that God brings across. And maybe we need to develop a rhythm where we expect the unexpected each day, you know, whether it's the inconvenient neighbor on our street, or if it's, you know, our coworker, or even a lot of times our own kids, or maybe, you know, just random strangers we come across, that somehow instead of avoiding those moments that we look for and that we somehow embrace those opportunities to be interrupted. And maybe through that, that's how we get a better understanding of what it means to anticipate Christ and just the unexpected nature of it. And so as we close this morning, you know, that's why we come to the table each week, you know, to take the bread, to drink the wine. And for us, you know, to remember, not only is it to remember what Christ did for us on the cross, but it's to remind us that Christ is returning. And for us, you know, it should shape the way we live. You know, the money, the time, the abilities we have, you know, are we using it wisely? And maybe as we develop these rhythms of learning how to give things away, how to let go of things, and maybe how we actively use the talents God's given us, or maybe how we embrace some of these interruptions in our daily life. And maybe it's through that process, that's what helps us connect with Christ and really start anticipating his return. So let me pray for us.